Totally Football Show with 2020 Vision. Today we're asking, what's the difference between Martin Tyler and Prince Andrew? No difference, they both definitely enjoyed four seasons in Woking. And in a weekend rich in princely parallels, English men were barely breaking sweat as they scored abroad, teams of professional women were in action, and there were lots of happy finishes after they qualified for their first major finals. With three spots left to fill at next summer's Euros, we ran up all the international news and more in today's Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello, listener, to you and to our panel today, which is Daniel Story at the Football 365 in the Eye.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Top Welshman, Tom Williams.
Good morning, James.
Author of Do You Speak Football and proud possessor of a ticket for Cardiff City Stadium Tuesday night.
Indeed.
Wow, what a game.
Yeah, well, let's hope so.
And Michael Cox is here, captain of the triumphant Team Athletic at the Opta Quiz.
That is true. Thanks for reminding me.
Well, not at all, Michael. And since you're here, we had a couple of questions ask us for more info about the Opta Quiz, because it's such an intriguing event, the way it pits pundits together.
Yeah.
And ranks them.
I always assume no one else cares apart from people.
I care.
Yeah. But you seem to genuinely care.
I genuinely do. As you know, Totally only finished 11th. I mean, you say only, but we were level with the Times.
Yeah.
We were above the Football Association, who, lest we forget, basically invented the game of football. So, yeah. You know, that's something. Awkwardly, Michael and the Athletic were on the next table to us, which made for some...
Michael, is it true that the Athletic had pre-qualifying for your team?
No, it's not true. So there was about 8 people who wanted in, and there was only 4 in the team. So we had a lot of squabbling about how it was decided.
And there wasn't a tiebreaker.
No, because we couldn't decide on which Sporkle we should do as pre-qualifying. There was also a name out of a hat situation, which no one came out of very well, because there were 6 of us present for this ceremony. The first 2 names out of the hat were the 2 people who weren't there. And we then agreed to not honour the results.
Wow. Crikey. Well, you know, the ends justifying the means. Daniel, you tried the quiz for yourself off the Opta Sports website.
Yeah, on the train home last night. Duncan can validate that I got 68 points.
Oh, on your own?
Although that was with a few answers given out on the show, it should be said.
Okay. All right. Listener, you have a go yourself and best of luck. We'll get on to the Euro 2020 qualifying news.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Seventeen nations have now booked their automatic qualifying places at next year's European Championships, amongst them England, who put 11 unanswered goals past Montenegro and Kosovo. Also through Germany and Netherlands, the Dutch surviving their key clash at Windsor Park when Stephen Davis skied his penalty, but at least he didn't smash the light fittings. Northern Ireland head into the playoffs. Underdog story of the weekend. You could take your pick between Scotland winning in Cyprus to move into third in their group, with John McGinn getting his 5th goal at qualifying, or Finland, who after 34 qualifying campaigns that ended in failure, finally made it through to a finals. Finns can only get better. 3 places still to be sorted, 2 in Group D, where Switzerland, Denmark and Ireland are all in the mix, and Ireland-Denmark is the key game Monday evening, and 1 from Group E, where after a 2-0 win over Azerbaijan, Wales can book their place at Euro 2020 if they beat Hungary in Cardiff on Tuesday. All right. Excitingly, both Wales and Ireland are guaranteed a playoff place if they don't make it. Feeling that jeopardy yet?
Yes. I mean, it's an intriguingly poised scenario in Cardiff on Tuesday night, in that Wales have to win in order to qualify, and if they win, they will be through. Hungary also have to win, really, because if the match ends in a draw, they'll be guaranteed to finish above Wales. But Slovakia, who play their last game at home to Azerbaijan, can move level on points with Hungary with victory and would finish above them by virtue of head-to-head record. So basically, Hungary, Wales and Slovakia all go into their last games having to win.
All right. Well, you're coming off a victory, you personally, Tom.
Yes.
2-0 away in Azerbaijan, of which your manager, Ryan Giggs, said some of the quality of play was outstanding. We've improved since the Azerbaijan game in September. We're getting better and better. Do you agree?
Yeah, there's been clear progress the last few games. And even going back to the last international window, there were 2 quite impressive draws against Croatia and Slovakia in terms of the performances. I mean, no one's going to get carried away with a 2-0 win against Azerbaijan. But as we know, in international football these days, those games can be quite fiddly. And Wales were 2-0 up within 35 minutes, never looked in any danger of conceding, should have won it more comfortably. And you have to say, Ryan Giggs, who I think most people decided a long time ago was just going to be a useless manager, is getting a lot of big decisions right. I mean, he picked Chris Meppham, the Bournemouth centre-back, who hasn't played at all really this season, over Ashley Williams, who's been in great form. That paid off. He's brought Kiefer Moore, the Wigan centre-forward, into the team. He's done really well, scored the opening goal against Azerbaijan. And yeah, it feels like there's a bit of momentum there. And also, Aaron Ramsey makes his first appearance of the whole qualifying campaign, having been unavailable due to injury. And Giggs was able to manage the amount of playing time he got and also the amount of playing time that Gareth Bale got. So they go into the game on Tuesday basically with a fully fit squad, with a decent bit of momentum. And you sort of think, if you can't win at home to Hungary, with all due respect to Hungary, you probably don't deserve to automatically qualify anyway.
Fair. How excited are you to see Aaron Ramsey and Gareth Bale starting together? How rare is that?
It's become increasingly rare. It would be the first time that they've played together since November last year. So a year without having the two of them on the pitch at the same time. Obviously, they're Wales's key men. But you look at all the other players in that area of the pitch. Harry Wilson, who was really impressive against Azerbaijan. Daniel James, who's been Wales's standout player of the qualifying campaign. You've got David Brooks, who's out currently, the Bournemouth midfielder. Joe Allen's going to come back from suspension. It's actually quite difficult to fit all those players into the team. And I think that's one of the reasons why Kiefer Moore, who's a fairly one-dimensional player, has actually been quite a successful introduction to the team. Because when you've got that amount of ability in the attacking midfield roles, the centre forward can just be a sort of facilitator, the way that Olivier Giroud is for France, for example. So yeah, it's pretty exciting. It will be pretty crushing if Wales don't qualify, because obviously they've got the safety net of the playoffs, but having gone through the playoffs and failed in the not too distant past, I think that's something that everyone will be quite keen to avoid.
Galois in France saying, is Wales Golf Madrid the best fan chant ever, in support of Bale and a freshness in this world of capitalist supporter criticism?
It's certainly my favourite chant of this qualifying campaign. So for anyone unaware of the genesis of this chant, this refers to a comment that Pedro Mijatovic, the former Real Madrid striker, made on Spanish radio recently when he was talking about Gareth Bale's apparent priorities. And he said that it felt to him like it was Wales first, then golf, and then Real Madrid, which has been turned into a banner by multiple Wales fans in Azerbaijan over the weekend, and also a chant.
And Gareth pretty much confirmed it himself in the press conference.
I mean, kind of, yeah. He had an opportunity to say, no, I love playing for Real Madrid, that's very important to me, and he didn't say that. And right. He spoke about how much he loves playing for Wales. It's like being down the park with his mates on a Sunday. And to
his
be honest,
presence in the game was pretty controversial as well from a Madrid point of view, given that he'd missed the last month for Real.
Yeah, it's hard to avoid the feeling that he does prioritise Wales over Madrid. And ever since he went to Madrid, and certainly the last few years where he's had such a difficult relationship with the supporters there, I think for him, getting to go away on international duty just feels like an absolute breath of fresh air. He's played with the lads in the Wales squads all the way through the youth age groups. They've had all these incredible experiences together. And he just seems a much happier, you know, more relaxed person. And yeah, I'm sure those chants are music to the ears of the Real Madrid faithful.
Hungry Wales sounds like a child's board game.
Oh, right. That's nice.
Yeah. Wales hungry, though.
Yeah, no, so but I don't care. I thought of the joke.
could have come up with that in June when they had that actual fixture.
Right. And Hungary won 1-0, is that right?
Hungary won 1-0, yeah. I mean, Hungary aren't great shakes. It's quite a homogenous group. It was Croatia, Slovakia, Wales, Hungary, Azerbaijan. So obviously Croatia group favourites, World Cup finalists, ended up winning the group. But below that, there's not all that much between the teams.
What would your banner be, Tom? Would it go Wales? Totally donuts Wales?
I'll have to give this some thought. I think pizza would be on there.
Right.
Dinosaurs. I'm quite a big dinosaurs fan.
Are you?
Can I maybe make the flag and then bring it to the next podcast?
How does your passion for dinosaurs manifest itself?
Just sort of reading about dinosaurs.
Right.
When I have the opportunity.
What's the thing that annoys you most about the Jurassic Park / World series of films?
I think it's the fact that they're just not very good, the more recent ones. Because basically, Jurassic Park, everyone's familiar with the central premise. I'm sure I'm not ruining it for anyone. It's what happens if dinosaurs escape in the vicinity of humans.
Right.
And every film that there's been since then has just redone that. And consequently, it's getting quite stale. In terms of the sort of scientific accuracy of the films, the Velociraptors actually bear no resemblance.
Didn't they have feathers?
They had feathers and they were the size of turkeys.
Wow.
There's a dinosaur that did look like a velociraptor called a Deinonychus, which was my favourite dinosaur growing up. And that was the size of a velociraptor, similar sort of viciousness. And I feel it was unfairly overlooked when they went all in on the raptors in Jurassic Park. So a dinosaur for you all to look up.
I'm Jose Mourinho. I know a thing or two about being special. Football pundits who actually understand management, special. Winning the daily jackpot on Paddy Power games, not special.
Understood, Jose. Yes, someone wins an average £40,000 jackpot every single day. So if you win, don't think you're special. Daily jackpots by Paddy Power Games. Jackpots must be awarded by 11 p.m. and vary from day to day. Jackpot is shared with other operators. Available on selected games. T's and C's at paddypower.com. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
On Spotify, smart speaker, and podcast platforms everywhere. This is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Elsewhere, the Republic of Ireland this evening in Dublin are facing a crunch game with Denmark. Ooh, Daniel, who they've never beaten. Mm. Who'd have beat them 5-1 in their last visit. We did a big preview of this last week because it's this evening. Of course, since then, Denmark have gone and dismantled Gibraltar.
Mm, they will 6-0. Do that.
Yeah.
Mick McCarthy's come out and sort of accused the Danish team and management of giving Ireland too little respect, which is a kind of typical McCarthy playbook of sort of this siege mentality, everyone's against us thing. But yeah, huge pressure obviously on him. They've been miserable, but if they get the job done, then you can just about justify it on the basis that he's leaving pretty soon anyway.
They've only scored 6 goals in their 7 games today, and that is in a group that contains Georgia and Gibraltar, who've conceded 36 goals between them.
Wow.
So scoring goals is very much not a strength.
Not their thing. Okay, there is the safety net of the playoffs, which Northern Ireland will be going into after giving Netherlands a bit of a scare in their clash at Windsor Park. They're playing Germany tonight. There are 4 playoff spots available, Michael, in Euro 2020. 16 teams go in, 4 come out. That's how it works. The draw for that will be on the 22nd, which is middle of next week. Interesting.
One-legged semi-finals, it's important to point out.
Is it? So
at the home of the higher ranked.
So you go straight into a semi-final,
yep.
A one-legged affair,
yep.
And then you go through to a final.
Yes.
Yep.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
One final per
likely Bosnia
Nations League group.
Yeah. Okay. Likely Bosnia for Northern Ireland, I think.
Okay. All right, then. England. Well, after all that kerfuffle, all that unfortunate business, the weekend went really smoothly. Gareth Southgate's side through as group winners with a goal difference of plus 31. 7-0 against Montenegro and then 4-0 Sunday away at Kosovo. Such an entertaining team. Who watched this? Let's see.
Yeah. I did watch it. Kosovo?
Well, no, I was going to say England. Entertaining up front and pretty entertaining at the back as well.
Yeah, I think you can say the same for the Kosovo side as well, who are kind of minnows who don't play like minnows because in a few years maybe they won't be. But yeah, I thought there were loads of positives from England over the 2 games, actually. Obviously, so much potential going forward. I mean, Kane is now getting to the stage where we're looking at Wayne Rooney's goal-scoring record, which obviously was only broken a couple of years ago, and there's a good chance that he can surpass that. And it was just nice as well that some midfield players got in the goals, because we've really lacked that over the last few years. You know, after a period where we had Gerrard and Lampard, and okay, they didn't play together, but they did score goals from midfield. And this time around, after a bit of a break of players not contributing from that position, you had Oxlade-Chamberlain scored, Wink scored, Mason Mount scored. So there were so many positives. I know it was against relatively modest opposition, but I think there's a lot of players who will come out of that international break feeling kind of like they belong at international level. Mm.
Tom, you went to Wembley on Thursday, didn't you?
Yes, yeah. I think one of the things that stood out for me was the role of the fullbacks. Ben Chilwell getting 3 assists in the first half, which is a bit of a rarity, but also Trent Alexander-Arnold, who's been used very sparingly by Gareth Southgate. I think that was only his 4th competitive start against Montenegro. One of those had been a dead rubber group match at the World Cup. One of those are in the 3rd place playoff in the Nations League. And he's been the outstanding right back in English football for the past 2 seasons, arguably the outstanding right back in European football for the last 2 seasons. And we've just not really seen him. And obviously, we know from watching him playing with Liverpool what he brings to the team, and with the caveat that it was against quite feeble opposition. I mean, his range of passing is extraordinary. The number of balls sort of down the flank, switching the play. He got 1 assist against Montenegro, but was quite heavily involved. And you tend to think that that is now the 2 fullback roles nailed down. Chilwell doesn't have a huge amount of competition on that side of the pitch and has done very well. Trent Alexander-Arnold is clearly England's best right back. It feels like that team is taking shape, as we've said. The front three, whether it's Kane, Sterling, Sancho or Kane, Sterling, Rashford, is phenomenal and probably, I mean, actually not even probably, the most frightening attack in European football at the moment. The issues with the midfield, as it has been for so long.
And at the back, Daniel?
These last 4 or 5 days have probably nailed down a number of positions. I think it is now Rashford, Sterling, Kane. I think Rashford's done himself huge favours over the last few days. Sancho was slightly off it, as he has been for Dortmund recently. Hudson-Odoi was a little bit disappointing. So I think that's probably nailed down. Gareth Southgate's always said that Oxlade-Chamberlain would have started in the World Cup if he'd have been fit. So I think he probably will start next year as well. Winks has done himself no problems. Henderson seems the other automatic pick there. Against better teams, you do worry about the lack of proper holding midfielder. But Declan Rice is not—he's not really justified the faith so far. I think he's probably been picked because he's changed nationality at the moment, rather than because he's played well enough. To me, the only other position that's open is the other central defender. Southgate's given Mings a go. I'm not entirely convinced by Mings. He seems to make those John Stones-style issues where he looks really good at times and then suddenly, out of nowhere, produces a mistake. But we're potentially going, you know, 7 months away from a tournament with just one position to fill, which is good, I think.
Okay. So the concern from ITV's pundits post the Kosovo game was that the positions that have been filled at the back don't seem to know what they're doing on set pieces and are continually giving up chances, and that when England come up against, this may sound familiar, a stronger team, they'll all of a sudden come up very short indeed.
Yeah, which is the issue about the lack of holding midfielder, because I think if Southgate had one who was in better form than Declan Rice, he probably would start every game or every game against tough opposition. And the reality of scoring, plus 31 goal difference is that you don't get tested that often, and when you do, it's in a friendly scenario. So that is an issue, but it's very hard to look at negatives from such positive results and performances.
Really. All right. How about the boos for Gomez? Tom, you were there at Wembley.
Yeah, it was a really curious thing to witness, in that at that stage of the game, England were 6-0 up. You know, they've secured qualification, they've secured top spot. Everyone's having a great time. And then Gomez appears on the touchline, and as he comes on, there were quite a lot of boos. Even more than a smattering, I would say. Obviously, the word that you go to is smattering, but I think it was possibly even more than that.
And what would you put that down to?
I mean, it's hard to know with England fans, because you get they're quite a different or quite a difficult crowd to sort of.
It's a broad church.
It's a broad church. I think part of it will have been, you know, you get sort of, and this is not to in any way, you know, sort of be disdainful towards them, but you get a lot of people who perhaps don't watch all that much football, you know, perhaps don't watch all that much top-level football. And so a trip to Wembley is a chance to see their heroes. And obviously Raheem Sterling is, you know, the England star of the moment. So was it people who were annoyed that they couldn't get a chance to see Sterling? And also Wembley is Raheem Sterling's home patch, lest we forget. So was there a local element?
The East and Massive were out.
I think it was just a case of people see names in headlines, and as soon as they see a name, they think it's bad news. I think if Sterling had come on instead of Gomez, I think they'd have probably might have booed him. I just think people are idiots at times. But there's no other... I mean, that's not tarring them all with the same brush, but there is no other explanation for someone booing Joe Gomez in that instance, other than he or she is being idiotic.
Yeah,
that there's no other explanation for that. It is an idiotic thing to do.
All right. Well, Neasden locals will be seeing plenty of matches at Wembley next summer, because England's group games are all confirmed at being there at the nation's football centrepiece. Michael, this is exciting news. Where they'll be taking on a group that will be comprised. Do you care about this? Who's going to be in the group?
I mean, only once this happened, really.
It's going to be one team from Scotland, Norway and Serbia.
Yeah.
One team from Bulgaria, Israel and Romania, although that could change, apparently. But that's as it stands. Mm-hmm. That's the group's looking okay so far. The other two teams in the group will be decided in the draw coming up next Saturday in Bucharest. But it won't be Italy, the Netherlands, Spain or Germany or the other six hosts.
Is next Saturday?
Yeah.
A week.
What time?
A week Saturday.
I don't know what...
I think it's mid to late afternoon.
Oh, wait, too big a pun. It's a week on Saturday.
Yeah, the 30th.
The 30th of November,
okay. I do like a draw.
Do you?
I get really excited. Like, you know, everyone complains about all the cultural festivities they have before the draw and all the really awkward chats with ex-players. I just really like all that ceremony. It reminds me of Eurovision, which is never a bad thing.
Good. Well, this one's going to be in Hungary, so I imagine they'll be laying it on thick there.
I'm doing the ESPN live blog of
Are
the draw,
you?
So if anyone's at a loose end, will I be there? No.
In Budapest.
That's the beauty of it. You don't need to be, do you? Yeah.
from a safe distance. Good. England have two friendlies before they kick off their Euro campaign, etc. and so on. But before the Euros, two friendlies for Gareth to fine-tune his team. Gareth has previously confided in me that he does love to listen to the show. So if he's across this one, Michael, who would you recommend that that Gareth you put in your team?
Well, I think maybe more interesting is who won't be in the team.
All right, then. Who
if I can answer the question that way. Yep. Well, just I listed down what I think will be the first team and the backups, and not included in that is quite a few players who were fundamental parts of the World Cup side. Mm. So I'm not sure about Kyle Walker, Jesse Lingard, Eric Dier, Dele Alli, Ruben Loftus-Cheek played at the World Cup, Ashley Young's definitely gone, and Kieran Trippier is probably on the verge of losing his place. And these are not 30-something players. They're players who probably expected that they'd be pretty regular for the next 5 years. So he really has moved on a generation that people weren't quite calling for them to be moved on. So I think it's quite interesting. But yeah, I think there's the question mark is in the midfield, I think, where there's just not quite the right balance of players.
Who would you have, Michael?
Well, I don't really get Declan Rice, I must say. I think I'd get rid of him from the squad, actually, at the moment. He might turn out to be a very good player.
Who would your midfield be?
I would play Winks, Henderson, and I think Oxlade-Chamberlain will play.
Right.
And then I think the players who come in would be Mount, Maddison, maybe Dier, just because he can play two positions.
Right.
As I say, that's the one place in the squad that we don't have any effective backup, is that holding, or even a starter, that holding centre midfielder. Southgate wanted Dier to be it. He isn't. He wanted Rice to be it. I agree with Michael. I don't think he is it. There's not really anyone else, unless... You know, unless he did play Trent Alexander-Arnold in midfield for a while against Montenegro, and he does have more backup at right back than any other position on the pitch, so he could play Trippier and Alexander-Arnold, but it would be a heck of a stretch in a European Championship game.
Could play John Stones in central midfield.
Yeah,
I don't think he will, but if Stones were to get a run there for City, which isn't inconceivable, that could be a solution.
Yeah, centre back's the other position. You'd imagine it's Stones, Mings, or Tomori to start if they all continue in the form that they are. But no one's shouting out for it, are they?
I think the problem is, and it goes without saying, that it will be tougher once we get to the tournament rather than the qualification. But I think England are very well set up to batter minnows. I think the two problems are the holding midfield position, and what we haven't mentioned is the goalkeeper, because at the moment we haven't really faced many shots. But Pickford's form since the World Cup, he had a very good World Cup, but I think most people think that was a slightly charitable reflection of his goalkeeping ability.
I see. Tom, did you want to throw something in here?
Yeah, I mean, just to say that historically England have struggled to produce genuine holding midfielders. It's been a blind spot in the history of the national team almost as far back as you can go. We're very good at producing box-to-box midfielders, the sort of archetypal English midfielder, and lots of creative midfielders at the moment. But yeah, there's not a single world-class holding midfielder in all of England, which is why, I mean, yeah, as Michael mentions John Stones, I wouldn't be surprised if Southgate tries that.
Why is that, do you think?
I think it's a cultural thing. I think lads who play in midfield in this country generally want to be either box-to-box players or number 10s. I don't think there's all that much respect for that position. And even guys who've played that position in tournaments, Owen Hargreaves, Gareth Barry, they've been much more kind of proactive midfielders. I mean, the job of a holding midfielder is quite a boring one. You just get the ball off the centre-backs, you sort of maintain the team shape, you need an awful lot of tactical intelligence. It's not very dynamic, but I don't think that, and maybe this goes, I don't know, I mean, you know, maybe this is something to do with the way that kids are sort of brought through in academies or something, but I don't think there's the same respect for the importance of that position as there is in countries like France and Italy or wherever.
France, Eduardo Camavinga, for example.
The slightly ironic thing is that probably the last aggressive holding midfielder we produced in Paul Ince actually was exported out to Italy, where we might expect that they would produce better players than us. But yeah, I think he was the last one that could be considered European class or continental class in his position.
And even he was more of a box-to-box player than a pure holder.
Fascinating. All right, well, one or two concerns for Gareth Southgate then ahead of next summer's European Championships. But by and large, a pretty positive state of affairs. We'll have a little bit more Euro news coming up. But next up, time to talk about the finish. Lordy, that is Lordy, Hard Rock Hallelujah, who you're a big fan of, Michael, on account of their Eurovision roots.
I wouldn't say big fan of, I remembered they won Eurovision.
Wow.
As I've mentioned previously on this very episode, I like Eurovision.
You certainly do. Anyway, Lordy still rocking, as you can hear for yourselves. Of course, top Finnish artiste. Finland actually boasts more heavy metal bands per capita than any other nation in the world. They also have more saunas, including one in the Burger King in Helsinki. They're the Ice Hockey World Champions, as you may know if you were listening to our excellent podcast series back in May. They're also, Tom, the happiest nation in the world, ranked thusly in March of this year for the second year in a row, beating off stiff competition from Iceland, Denmark, the Netherlands and Norway, other global centres of contentedness. And, of course, adding to their current state of felicitation is a 3-0 win over Liechtenstein on Friday, which means that they are going to Euro 2020, their first ever major championship. Well, the scenes there at the full-time whistle on Friday, as after 34 failed campaigns, Finland finally made it through to a major championships. On the line now from Finland is our friend Tommy Vilberg of Hruppstedsbladet, or HBL, as he prefers that I say. Hi, Tommy.
Hello.
Eten pein on menti.
Definitely, yeah.
Right. What have I just said?
Roughly translated to, we have made some steps forward.
Well, I'll say, what were the scenes like on Friday and indeed this weekend after this famous qualification?
Well, in one word, chaos. I mean, people were just flooding the streets of Helsinki, celebrating till the early morning hours, or maybe the whole week, and it was big for Finnish football.
We saw with the Finnish team at the World Cup of ice hockey this summer that even without established names, though, they can spring a huge surprise. Is there a similar kind of spirit to the football team?
Definitely, yeah. Our biggest star is Teemu Pukki, who has had an amazing season, or amazing couple of last seasons. But he's like the only big star. Then there are just, well, again, it's a good team. There are guys who are ready to work their butts off for each other, and that's the beauty of the team, I think.
How was my Finnish there, Tom? I was trying to bust out. That's a famous Finnish expression I was using.
Yes, I have written about the language of Finnish football in my book, but I don't know how to pronounce a lot of the words in that book because I've never had to pronounce them. Okay. I only had to write them. Not an expert on Finnish pronunciation.
Is there not an audio book?
There's not an audiobook. Someone was asking me about this on Twitter the other day. It would be a great audiobook, but you'd need to pronounce things in about sort of 50 different languages.
Just say it really loudly.
Or just say it really loudly, yeah, with associated hand gestures.
But no, eten pein on menti, that was a catchphrase of the Finnish national coach, is that right?
Yes.
Onwards and onwards. Whose
name? Okay, I got this from your book.
Yeah.
His name was something like Antti Muurinen.
Yes, and it was during a time when Finland was struggling, right, as they often have, as a nation of their size, and he clung to this phrase, we have gone forward, we have made a step forwards, even in the face of very strong evidence to the contrary. And he sort of repeated it so often that it became this kind of cult phrase. And it gave its name to a Finnish football magazine.
Probably the Finnish football magazine.
I mean, quite probably.
Okay. What other Finnish footballing idioms did you have in your book?
There's one of my favourite terms in the whole book, actually, is the Finnish name for a holding midfielder, which is pikatapi. Pikatapi means fecal plug.
Fecal plug,
and it specifically refers to the matter that forms in the colon of a bear while the bear is hibernating.
Plug.
A bear's fecal plug, and then when it emerges after hibernation in the spring,
right,
it gives its bum a shake, and this little lump of hardened crud falls out onto the ground. And apparently, if you are strolling through the forests of Finland, which is teeming with bears, these little lumps of poo are quite a common sight. And
right,
and the thinking in fecal a football plugs context is that it's like the central midfielder who plugs the hole in front of his team.
Exactly
defense.
The position that we don't have. And
well, yeah, exactly.
Right, Michael.
Do you know which host country have a language that is very similar to Finnish? Hungary, weirdly.
Oh, right, okay. Nice.
It's just a weird little fact because you wouldn't expect it, would you?
No.
But apparently they're very similar languages.
Okay, then.
That's the end of my fact.
Thanks, Michael. Meantime, speaking of plugs, in a week's time, we're going to be in Liverpool for the final date of our 2019 Totally Football Live series. You're not going to be with us this time, Michael, sadly.
Sorry.
In your stead, we'll have Duncan Alexander, Julian Arona, Raphael Honigstein, who apparently is going to be signing his Jurgen Klopp book. There'll also be some other prizes and things for Everton supporters as well. And it's all going to be very exciting. That's going to be at the Epstein Theatre from 7 p.m. Monday the 25th of November. Tickets are available probably still at thetotallyfootballshow.com. Any other international news we should be covering before we move on from the qualifiers? France are through, top of the group, Belgium. France may not be, they're not going to be playing at home though, that's bizarre.
They're not going to be playing at home, and it doesn't look like they're going to be one of the top six seeds either. So they could be a dangerous floater.
They might be in England's group, actually. Belgium had a terrific result. Did you see they went to Russia and smashed them 4-1 with both Hazards on the score sheet?
Romelu Lukaku up to one fewer international goal than Wayne Rooney managed in his entire career, which seems remarkable for a 26-year-old.
That's true.
The weekend is, it feels more than ever like there's no standout candidate because France have kind of just gritting and stumbling their way along. Germany have apparently in this sort of redux. Spain flunked at the last one. We don't really know what to expect. It does feel very, very open.
What about Belgium?
Yeah, very much like Liverpool leading the Premier League. The reason to not think they'll do it is because they've never done it before, and therefore you have these sort of inherent doubts in the back of your mind. But they've got a heck of a team, so why not? It's just whether the manager is good enough, I think.
And just to pick up on Daniel's point, not only is there not really one outstanding team, it kind of feels like a bit of a year zero for an awful lot of the major nations, but also all the big countries have qualified, and we've got used to in recent years seeing Holland or Italy or whoever missing out on the big tournament. You think, oh, great lineup. It's a pity so-and-so aren't here. Obviously, qualifiers haven't yet finished, but generally all the teams that you'd want to be there are there.
Right.
And yeah, although there were some really impressive, there have been some really impressive performances in the qualifiers, and I suppose France are favourites by dint of being the defending world champions, it kind of feels like, you know, there's a lot of team who are roughly on the same sort of level and are still finding out about themselves.
All right. That redhead dude, actually, right, who do you think's the favourite for Euro 2020, Michael, I'm not sure what your take is.
I think France are the best team by a long way, and yeah. I wouldn't read too much into the qualification results, just as I wouldn't read too much into England, you know, putting seven past Montenegro. It doesn't really matter. I think France have got a very disciplined side,
right.
Very solid defence, and they've got individuals in attack who can make the difference.
Okay, Ricardo.
James, they tried out a new system last night. France, they played with a back three for the first time since 2004 or something. And okay, they were only playing away to Albania, but they looked pretty good. And it put Antoine Griezmann in the sort of number 10 role. It was
right.
a 3-4-1-2. He had Giroud and Wissam Ben Yedder ahead of him, and he absolutely bossed it. And you can forget what a talented footballer he is sometimes when you watch him at Barcelona playing second fiddle to Messi and Suarez. I think the issue with France is that they don't feel like they've evolved since the World Cup in the same way that the team that followed up victory at the 98 World Cup went on to win Euro 2000. They were a much more flamboyant team. Zidane was at his absolute peak. They brought Henri into the team and he was the main man. I think that's the only issue for France is, I mean, that they've got that foundation, the goalkeeper, the back four, the central midfield.
Who is the goalkeeper at the moment?
Well, currently it's Steve Mandanda because Hugo Lloris is out injured, but Lloris was interviewed over the weekend and he'll be back in January. And the team from the World Cup hasn't really evolved. The only player who's managed to muscle his way into the team is Clément Longley, who's taken Samuel Umtiti's place, as he has with Barcelona. Kingsley Coman has had a very impressive qualifying campaign and looks like the most likely to come into that attack. But you know, there are issues with Giroud not playing very much at Chelsea, with where you put Mbappe. So that's, I think, the only issue that France have is how they configure that attack and whether they can find a way of playing that makes them a slightly more proactive team. But yeah, in terms of the fundamentals, they're pretty solid.
Didier Deschamps reaching his 100th game in charge with that win yesterday over Albania. Ricardo Mantio says, what's the vibe in Italy at the fledgling Mancini project? Can they compete after years of disappointing? They haven't done that. I mean, the new last time didn't work out. But everyone's wildly enthusiastic. And even Arrigo Sacchi saying that they are a model to follow, that where the clubs are not playing progressive football, Mancini's Italy is absolutely showing the way in terms of a progressive approach to the game, which is interesting because they didn't really see eye to eye when Mancini was busy being excluded from Sacchi's Azzurri project. I mean, the questions there, I think we had somebody mentioning the other day about the lack of a bona fide goal scorer up front.
It's Immobile or nothing, isn't it?
Really? Well, no, because, I mean, Belotti, I think, can do it and look really good. When was it? Saturday they played when they went to Bosnia-Herzegovina and won 3-0, which is an impressive result. The real strength of the team is the midfield, where after the kind of post-Pirlo blues, they finally got some creativity there with... it was Jorginho Tonali of Brescia, who everyone's very excited about, and Barella this time. But they've also got Sensi and, of course, Verratti ready to come in. Michael?
One thing you don't need to win a major tournament is a bona fide goal scorer.
Do you not?
2018, Giroud didn't score. 2016, Portugal didn't play anyone up front. 2014, Germany didn't know who to play up front. 2012, Spain played without a striker.
There you go. Man's got a point.
Yeah. And one or two question marks at the back, with Chiellini still being out and Bonucci not looking quite the same thing. But by and large, I mean, they've won 10 games in a row now, which is a record for Italy. And they're playing Armenia Monday night and can finish the group with a 100% record. Right. Great. Well, very shortly, we'll be turning our attention to the Women's Football Weekend, which took place this weekend, and well, naturally, and saw all sorts of records shattered, some pretty top clashes as well. And we'll also be turning our thoughts to Mark Simmons' question, which football data topic should he choose for his master's dissertation? Some shock answers coming up on that one. First of all, though, let's get some odds on the international football that we've just been talking about, courtesy of Paddy Power in conversation with producer Ben.
You still there, listeners? Of course you are. Lee Price is on the line from Paddy Power to wrap up this international week. Lee, let's start with the big game that Tom's been talking about, Wales versus Hungary. Can the Welsh do it?
Yeah, we're quite confident. Simple equation for Wales: win and they're through, fail to win and they're in the craziness of the playoffs. We think they will. It's 8-13, odds on they get the victory they so need. Hungary, a pretty chunky 4-1, bear in mind they're second in the group at the minute. The draw's 5-2, but the Hungarians haven't drawn yet. And Wales will be hoping they don't start here.
All right, and let's gaze ahead to the tournament itself. Who are the favourites to be the overall winners of Euro 2020?
This is kind of surreal to say, and people think I'm joking, actually, when I say that recently. But England are amongst the favourites of Euro 2020 and have been since the last World Cup. Fair enough. They're now joint favourites alongside France at 4-1 after the weekend's games. Belgium are third favourites at 13-2. And then you have a triumvirate of real heavyweights: Germany, Spain, Holland, all at 8-1. Portugal, Italy are 12-1. Croatia, World Cup finalists no less, are 25-1.
And while we're at it, give us the top scorer markets too, please.
Early days here, obviously there could be a few goal scorers that arrive via the playoffs and other such methods. But for now, Harry Kane and Cristiano Ronaldo are joint favourites around 7-2. That won't surprise you. Romelu Lukaku, 7-1. Interesting shout, maybe. Antoine Griezmann's at 15-2, ahead of teammate Kylian Mbappe at 8-1. The same price as Eden Hazard. And what about Robert Lewandowski? A great goal scoring start to the season. He's 12-1 to win the Golden Boot Euro 2020. Probably depends on Poland getting out of their group.
You can find out those odds and more at paddypower.com or via the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Now, records broken again in WSL in the Women's Football Weekend, which saw four of the six fixtures played at Men's Premier League or Championship grounds and some big clashes as well. North London Derby, big fixture between the two front runners in the WSL, Chelsea and Man United. To tell us what went down, let's speak to our friend from the Offside Rule, Lindsay Hooper.
Hello, James.
How was your North London Derby experience?
It was incredible. I have to say that I got a little bit emotional walking towards the new Spurs Stadium. Not just for that, though, James. It was everybody that had turned out, the families, my journey there, packed trains. You just knew that there was going to be an incredible atmosphere there, and it was going to be a signifying moment for the game, because I think this is what everybody's been working towards. We've seen big crowds at FA Cup finals. That's been happening over the last few years. Everybody who's been following women's football will remember the huge crowd that was at Wembley for the 2012 Olympics when Team GB competed. But this is the first time we've seen crowds like this attending WSL matches, which is the equivalent of going to a Premier League match in the men's. But is something that's been long, long overdue for the women.
Well, put it in perspective. So 38,262 fans at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, which is more than seven times higher The previous record for a WSL game, I say previous, that had stood coming into this season. It's a quantum leap, but it's because of this decision to move into the men's Premier League and Championship grounds. No, the interesting thing though was that Chelsea, for example, who were playing at their ground, still got a record crowd for them, didn't they, for the game with Man United?
They had a sellout at King's Meadow, and I actually think that is the most impressive attendance of the weekend, which sounds ludicrous when you think over 38,000 were at the Spurs Stadium. But when you look at the week-in, week-out fixtures that happen at these smaller stadiums, King's Meadow, that's the capacity. I think it was 4,790. Well, to actually sell it out is something that we've not been anywhere near doing in seasons gone by. So to move in that momentum and to hope that, you know, when there isn't just a football women's weekend that's been highly promoted, that fans are still going to turn out, to try and get round about 5,000 to each of these WSL matches would be a significant lead.
Absolutely. A nice result for Chelsea as well. 1-0 win over Man United. Slightly underwhelming game, would that be fair, at King's Meadow?
Yeah, I think so. But I think everyone's now waiting, aren't they, for Sam Kerr to be revealed and unveiled and unleashed in the first match. She's not quite with the squad yet, but I think that will have a huge impact. There might be a little bit of uncertainty there as well with a few players because there's a lot of rotation. I think Emma Hayes has got a really difficult job keeping everyone happy. But Chelsea have been flying. So, you know, the home crowd will have been completely satisfied to see a 1-0 win. It's not always going to be 4 or 5-0, is it?
Daniel, you watched Man City this weekend.
Yeah, they kind of declared on five pretty much against... Well, they were 5-0 up at half-time and then had a player sent off and, yeah, stuck with 5-0. But I was just wondering, for Lindsay, obviously she talked about the retention. Like, how hard is that going to be, realistically, without hyping it up? Because one women's football weekend is, I guess, nice, but that's not the point, is it?
No, I think it is going to be difficult. I still think that records will continue to be broken this season. I think we'll see more of these matches being held at the men's stadiums. I think it's a lot to do with this one club effect. I think everyone showed, you know, Manchester United fans, Chelsea fans have done in the past, certainly Spurs fans did this weekend at the North London Derby, that they will go and support. And I think that there's always been this taboo that maybe, you know, men's football fans won't transition over to women's. But I think it's really shown that there's this other different atmosphere, maybe a family atmosphere. Maybe that's the thing that you like to go and do more as an adult in terms of going and watching the men's, but in terms of a family affair, and a younger crowd, that is something that still really has got a huge appetite for people to go to. So I think that the season is promising. I think it's going to be difficult to continue the sorts of figures we've been seeing. But if we can't do it now, when we've got an Olympics and a Euros coming, then I don't think it will ever really have the opportunity that it's getting right now.
Well, there's a full roundup at your Offside Rule WSL edition, which you recorded straight after the North London Derby at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Is that right?
We did, and producer Abby pulled a late one, managed to get it out last night, so it's out now. Everyone should go and listen to that. A little bit of a different feel. We actually decamped into one of the flash interview zones at Spurs, and just as people were walking down the tunnel, managed to grab managers, players. They just came in. We had a thoroughfare of people coming through. It was a really different podcast, so hopefully everyone enjoys the show.
Lindsay Hooper of The Offside Rule. Michael, you watched Spurs-Arsenal. What did you think?
I thought it was quite a poor quality game, actually. I don't think either side played to their potential. And I think it's interesting because obviously it's a good thing in the long term that, you know, playing at these big stadiums, getting bums on seats. But I think for Spurs, probably just sacrificed home advantage. You know, it was the first time that they'd played there, so it was almost like playing on a neutral ground. And I think the game was really characterised by being quite scrappy until the final half hour, when I think Arsenal's quality and probably superior fitness levels came into play. Kim Little scored a really, really good goal from the edge of the box. And Medema, well, got a bit of a gift from one of the defenders and rounded the goalkeeper. But she's a really good player. I mean, you know, obviously there's a lot of chat about Kerr coming, but Medema's just such a good all-round forward. Good with the back to goal, good in the air, can shoot with either foot, skillful, you know, just a kind of the kind of player you think, how do I stop her? You know, just so good in every area. But it was, it wasn't a great game, but great to see the attendance, obviously.
Right. Tell you what, Michael, let's finish off then with a quick question from Mark Simons, a.k.a. Squirrel Climb, who asks, which football data topic should I choose for my master's dissertation? It's interesting. Wonder what would that be a master's in, do you think? Statistics or...?
I did my dissertation on football and I did an accounting degree, so you can very much broad out, yes.
Wow, that's great. That's great. Well, so which football data topic? Now, you, Michael, and you, Daniel, have both replied to Mr. Squirrel Climb. Daniel, you suggested the decline of heading in modern football.
Mm.
Why is that something that fascinates you or you think is ripe for...
Because it is going down, and I think it's also quite interesting with the stuff about, you know, in the US that
like
they're banning, they're banning children from heading and stuff. So
yeah, I can't bear watching kids head footballs.
Mm.
I think that heading will disappear from football within our lifetimes. It's already on the way down.
Right.
With all the research we know about the links between heading footballs and various brain conditions, I think we'll reach a point where, I mean, if it's already being, you know, taken out of the game at youth level in different countries, I think the
natural progression... How are they taking it out? They're banning...
Well, like in the States, heading is banned for anyone playing football below the age of 13. I think there are other European countries who've started to follow suit as well. I think this is just the beginning.
Head height rule, maybe.
Ooh, no, I wouldn't go that far.
I look forward to the interminable analysis about what constitutes a header and what constitutes the neck.
Right.
To replace the handball debate for the next 20 years.
Right. Okay, so that's a pretty fruitful topic for discussion in a dissertation. Michael, you, on the other hand, have gone for the impact of 3 points for a win on the percentages of draws, although, as you say, this is possibly a bit 80s.
It is, yeah.
What would your contention be? Were you arguing this in a dissertation?
Well, I don't know. That's why I'm interested.
Oh,
but I mean, like,
right.
Obviously, you know, the 3 points for a win was brought in to
logic.
Encourage teams to attack, but I gather that it didn't have much impact.
Is that right?
Whereas I believe in the last 10 years, I think the proportion of draws that has fallen
right.
at the top level, which is probably just because of the inequality, the increased inequality between teams. So just stuff around draws could be interesting.
So giving 3 points for a win didn't have the effect that it was intended to have.
I believe that's true based upon...
Certainly not the difference they expected. Yeah.
Right. The word, Mark, that's going to be... when you find out, you know, after you've done the research, do let us know. Because Michael, for one, would dearly love to find out the answer to that. Tom?
Speaking of draws,
yes.
In 1997, the Colombian Football Association did away with draws.
What?
And decided that when matches finished level... teams would have a penalty shootout for the lost point. Because obviously when one team wins in 3 points for a win, you get 3 points. And if you lose, you get none.
Mm.
So it's a draw, there's a point each. But what happens to the third point?
What happens to it?
So in Colombia, they had a penalty shootout to decide it. And it was so stupid that they abandoned it after about a year.
Isn't that the same in the EFL Trophy?
Yeah,
they did.
As well.
They did that in the States as well, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, with the 35-yard penalty shootout.
The high point, yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant. Okay. Colombian shootouts. Very nice. Excellent. Well, that brings us to the end of today's international edition of the Totally Football Show. We're back on Thursday, being all Premier League centric with Lindsay Hooper. With Lindsay Hooper and Emma Saunders will be with us as well, and Duncan Alexander. So that's nice. In the meantime, many thanks to Michael, Daniel, and Tom for being with us, and you, listener. Have yourselves a great week. We'll catch up with you Thursday.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter, and make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.